Hello, this is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. In studio with me this week is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. We're going to point out to you at the very beginning here, this week's show has been pre-recorded, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls. But please do tweet your questions for any of our four mayors to @WBAANews on Twitter. You can also send emails to ask@WBAA.org. I do have a question for you that was tweeted to us this week that touches on something that you and I have discussed at length on this program. Mm-hmm. And the question asker wants to know, how can we get a frequent train to go south to Indianapolis instead of north to Chicago? It sounds like they want Amtrak to be more southward facing from Lafayette than northward facing.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and I wish I had the answer for it. But what I can tell the listener is that, you know, Amtrak is very receptive to suggestions. But like any business, my presumption is that they base it on ridership. And I'm just speculating here because the route was originally designed to head north, that they really haven't done any calculations to see what the potential ridership would be to go south. So I would suggest that she give a call to Amtrak and say, hey, what about southbound? And see what happens.
I wonder, does your office get any sorts of numbers on ridership to allow you to go back to the city council or to other stakeholders and say, here's the information you might need to try mm-hmm. to do whatever you want with them?
Yeah, we do. We actually, a gentleman, Robert Zier, he's the guy that generates all the reports for us every month, and it has all kinds of stuff from ridership to opinions about it to times to some of the other issues involved with Amtrak. So it's a pretty comprehensive report.
But it doesn't show ridership one way or the other or, you know, breakdown of
students
to residents or what have you.
Yeah, no, it would be kind of neat if they did. But the presumption is that it's mostly students that ride the train anyway. It's just kind of false because a lot of folks ride the train, head up to Chicago.
You and I talked last month on this program about those properties at the corner of Northwestern mm-hmm. and State, and you had said that there were people who were interested, but nothing had really mm-hmm. come to fruition yet. It led me to thinking about sort of an ancillary issue to that, which is parking in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. It is a nightmare, let's be honest. There's a parking lot across the way there, and I've heard horror stories from people who say that there are business owners there who make it their life to try to give parking tickets to people who are parking there without actually attending one of those businesses in mm-hmm. that strip. Would a greater emphasis on parking in that area make it easier to have closer to 100% occupancy in some of those more prominent district places that are not currently occupied?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't really know, because one of the challenges that we have is trying to figure out what is the best parking ratio, what's the best parking standard. A few years ago, we had proposed zero. You know, there were zero requirements for parking. First come, first serve. And that would go for businesses and would go for residential, because in most metropolitan downtown areas, that's pretty much how it stands.
Meaning no restrictions on amount of time you could park?
No restrictions. Each business is required to have so many parking spaces dedicated for their business. And that's why it's at such a premium, because if they have hypothetically six spots for their business, those six spots are continuously full, but they just roll over. In major metropolitan areas and even smaller metropolitan areas, it's zero. It's just you come when there's an available space, you take what you got. If it's metered, you put your money in the meter, or if not, you go ahead and stay for as long as the time allows. But it's a continuous shift. When we had those conversations, one of the concerns was, for the most part, that it might be beneficial to the businesses, but it could be detrimental to the near campus residential areas, because it would push traffic into the residential areas. And obviously that's an issue, a completely different issue. So we wanted to make sure that we didn't over-densify the downtown area with random parking. And then that way we could actually, in a way, guarantee turnover, so the businesses continue to have fresh customers coming in.
Although people are only going to walk so far. I mean, I think there's a finite distance past which people would not park their cars to walk to some downtown business. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there are a relatively small number of residences within that, mm-hmm. within, say, a four-block radius of any part of downtown, mm-hmm. right?
Well, you'd be surprised. A lot of them are student residents, like mostly high-density residents, the apartment complexes.
Sure.
They, too, have to comply with the parking ordinance. But what we have found in our research is that parking is a very, very serious commodity in our community, as it is in most college towns. When you've got the density of students or the density of humanity that we do here in West Lafayette, parking is a challenge. It's not just a challenge in our downtown area. It's also a challenge in our neighborhoods. We've done things in the neighborhoods to try and accommodate the needs of the residents there, the permanent residents, and we're also looking at ways to better accommodate the businesses. As it stands right now with Purdue, it's predominantly pedestrian traffic. And as the transition shifts from bicycles, from cars to bicycles and walkers, we're going to see where the parking is becoming less of an issue. And that understanding is basically what we're using with our State Street Master Plan. And that's a concept that we're trying to become more bike friendly. And we're trying to recognize that if people can walk to a business, they're going to patronize it probably more frequently than if they have to drive.
I want to get to the master plan in a few minutes. But first, I wanted to know a couple of other things. One, I lived in Bloomington for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. And one thing Bloomington has just done is they've gone to more metered parking.
Yes.
And it was incredibly controversial when mm-hmm. it happened. Was that ever on the city's radar in terms
yes.
of keeping people from spending too much time in one place because it hits them in the pocketbook?
Yes. Parking metered parking technology has just grown phenomenally in the past few years. It used to be, you might be too young to remember this, but you'd slap a pin in there and you'd crank it down and you would get 15, 20 minutes to up to an hour if you put in more money. Well, now it's all computerized. You can use swipe credit cards. You can buy like chits or, you know, little documents that you can just slide in and out. And it is more accommodating towards the customer. We have looked at that concept down in the Village area. In the Village area where we have Starbucks, where we have some Panera restaurant and some other businesses down there, the business owners are very focused on trying to get that parking to turn over every hour. And so they are very demanding on the part of enforcement to make sure that we're there in the event that somebody overstays their welcome, basically their timed welcome. And that creates a lot of controversy amongst our citizenry and our student residents, because what happens is you go there to have lunch or you have a lunch meeting, you go beyond the allocated time limit and you get ticketed. And the concentration of vehicles are generally there during meal hours. They're there in the morning time, they're there at lunch, and then they're there in the evening. And then they're virtually, the stalls are very much available throughout the rest of the day. And the perception is that the enforcement requirements are subjective because they only ticket people during those busy business hours. So what we were looking at doing is we were having a conversation about the concept of metering that area and seeing how it might work, seeing how receptive it would be with our public. And if it was a success down there, then we would also look at it in the Village area, because it really is a revenue generator.
Well, on the same score, though, it is incredibly unpopular with, I think, most everywhere that you put in a parking meter, people are going to be unhappy going from previously free spaces to ones that they now have to pay for any period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be something the city would obviously have to overcome.
Well, and that's where this conversation starts becoming more of a public debate. Oftentimes, people who own a business want the turnover. They want cars in, they want them out, they want them in, because that way they get more customers through the front door. The people who are driving want to have a place where they can park and then do what they need to do, which might not be on the same time schedule as the metered parking or just basically the parking requirements that we have in the Village area. So it is sort of a tug of war. It's a difficult solution to apply to. That's why when you're in a position like we are with the State Street Master Plan, you can engineer areas to where parking isn't necessarily the focal point of getting people into your business. You know, you can put it on bike trails, you can put it on, pedestrian paths, you can make it more accessible to those folks that are going to be walking around the Village area. And that way it eliminates that concern about parking.
When Bloomington did this a year or two ago, one of the other things that was in their plan was make it more obvious to people that there are other options for parking, such mm-hmm. as parking garages.
Mm-hmm.
And the corporation that Bloomington contracted with even set out in its plan to the city, they said, look, you need more signage, be it on-street signing, be it on posts mm-hmm. around the downtown, direct people to the parking structures that you have in place so that those are utilized mm-hmm. more effectively. Has that been talked about, especially in the Chauncey Village area? Because there are parking garages
sure.
within a short distance.
Sure. The oddity is we did when Wang Hall was being built, a couple of our counselors went ahead and they did a physical walkthrough of our parking garages to make sure that there was available parking space for Wang Hall and the potential folks that would be going in there to work and then patronize businesses. And they found that there are available spaces. The downside of that is there are available spaces because people don't like to use parking garages. Some people actually have a phobia of parking garages. They will not go into one. I've got a relative that's that way. They just don't care if that's the last place to park on the planet. I will drive a mile away and walk as opposed to going into a parking garage. So the concept of parking garage, yeah, fantastic. We have a parking garage right there at the levee that is never utilized. And we've done as much as we can, even to the point of offering free parking there. And people just generally don't go into the parking garages. And again, that's something way beyond my pay grade. I don't know why that's what their choice is, but that's how they roll. One of the concepts that has had some success in college towns is the remote parking areas with buses. You basically are chauffeured from a parking area into the business area and then chauffeured back.
And this is something you see a lot of apartment complexes doing too.
Right. And again, that serves two purposes. Obviously, it keeps the concentration of traffic out of the downtown area, and it also provides a catered service to get folks to and from the businesses. And it seems to be somewhat successful. The downside of that is that when, again, your hours aren't necessarily the same as the shuttle service, that creates challenges. But that's something that we've had here for years and years. I mean, even when I was a kid, parking was a high commodity over here in West Lafayette. One of the other things that we've run into is in the bar area. A lot of kids will drive cars to the bars, and then they act responsibly, and they have a few too many cocktails, and they decide instead of driving home, they leave their car in the parking lot overnight. And that creates another problem that we're trying to resolve. The property owners say, okay, this isn't a place for your car to stay, so we're going to have you towed. So they clear the lot in the early hours of the morning, sometime usually before 8 o'clock. And that creates a problem as well.
A perverse incentive to drive drunk.
Correct. And we absolutely don't want to encourage that.
You've mentioned a couple of times the State Street Master Plan. What is the latest on that? Where does it stand at the moment?
Well, we are rocking that pretty hard. We've got a committee together. It includes administrators from Purdue University as well as administrators from my office. And we are meeting, having conversations about trying to get this done as quickly as possible. President Daniels, obviously, is very supportive and very, very vocally behind it. And the big thing is now is looking at revenue options and figuring out how to best pay for this, and then doing some of the preliminary engineering, trying to figure out things such as traffic counts, traffic flow, and just looking at the corridor specifically from the Wabash River up to Grant Street and figuring out some preliminary design work on that, because it is a huge, huge project. I've often referenced this period as our renaissance, because this really is going to change the entire makeup of the city of West Lafayette. First and foremost, we are going to have a city instead of a village area. And second off, it's going to be done with the understanding of what our population base wants now. You know, we want bike trails. We want pedestrian paths. We want to be able to access businesses easily. We want to make sure that parking concern isn't so much of a focal point. And we want to make sure that the businesses that are going to be there are the businesses that our students and our permanent residents want to patronize.
On the other hand, it could be like the Big Dig was in Boston, where people said for years, when is this hole in the ground going to be gone, and when are we going to get our city back?
Yeah. Is it done yet?
My impression is it'll be going on till we're both long gone.
I think that's more of an employment thing as it is much of a public works project.
So what do you do to forestall that sort of concern from people of, we need to get this done quickly, mm-hmm. we need to get it done? Obviously, you've got this college town mentality of construction happens in the summer primarily, especially road construction, but this is going to take longer than a summer to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If we can get this first portion done in 5 years, that's a job well done. The biggest challenge that we have, and you got pretty close to it, Stan, is once we do this, we are taking a major artery through our community and severing it. So the blood flow needs to go somewhere else. So we need to make sure that we can engineer the bypasses around and the detours around that area. That's one of our preliminary focal points. The dark side of any kind of project of this scope is the revenue. And we are cautiously optimistic that we're going to be able to get this thing started quickly with some cash infusions. And that's going to make everybody understand that this isn't just going to be, you know, kind of a start-stop process. You know, we really want to make sure that we knock it out of the park as quickly as possible. Because of all the meetings that we had when we were crafting the State Street Master Plan, the idea is still relatively fresh in our business owners and our population's minds. So there still is a lot of enthusiasm about it. And probably one of the coolest things is that there's a lot of enthusiasm with the two administrations, with Mitch's and with mine. And with both of us pulling on the same side of the rope like that, this thing should happen. Keep your fingers crossed quickly.
As far as the revenue goes, I'm sure the dozens and dozens of business owners along this corridor are worried about their revenue.
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. And that's, again, one of those engineering challenges. You know, when we were crafting the plan, the business owner said, okay, wait a second. If you dig up this road, how are people going to come to my tavern, to my restaurant, to my bookstore? And that's one of the things that we assure them. We are in a position to create those detours that will guide people right to your businesses. But the end result will be that your business will increase. So it's my understanding that all the businesses were supportive of the master plan, and they look forward to it starting and then obviously coming to fruition.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're chatting with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. This show has been pre-recorded, so we can't take your phone calls this week. We do offer you the option, though, to tweet questions for any of our mayors to ask at WBAA News on Twitter. You can also email to ask@WBAA.org. Well, now that city leaders have voted to make this a second-class city, a Class 2 city, you again have to redistrict, and that, of course, is never an easy thing to do. Mm, yeah. But it has to be done quickly, is my understanding, before the November election, so that you've got the 1 year waiting period before municipal elections, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The good thing about our councils, we just went through this exercise about a year and a half ago. We redistricted the former footprint of the city of West Lafayette, so our council's pretty well versed at the pitfalls of not having a collaborative spirit when we do this. With our new footprint, the biggest challenge that we have is making sure that the numbers add up. Some of the requirements are pretty specific about you can't gerrymander a district to benefit a specific political entity. The numbers have to be balanced. In other words, you can't have a concentration of folks in one district and then a sparsity of folks in another district. And that they have to be basically logical. And I know that that's very subjective. But you can't, say, break up a neighborhood like you couldn't go in and break up Barbary Heights into several smaller districts. It's got to be respectful of the existing boundaries of neighborhoods, and it's also got to be respectful of the existing districts.
So you mentioned the G word, gerrymandering, which gets talked about any time that redistricting gets talked about. And, of course, I would argue the stakes are not as high municipal elections as they are in, say, congressional elections where gerrymandering is common as common could be. Mm-hmm. But how do you avoid people coming back to you and how do you avoid any inkling that there was any sort of political motivation? I mean, because it would seem like the first time an election comes down the way somebody doesn't want it to, they throw the G word at you and you have to defend yourself.
Yes, absolutely. Well, again, with the council's focus now is, and they said it at the meeting last night, that they don't want to redistrict somebody out of their job, basically. So they're going to be respectful of who's in which district and where those districts are geographically located. One of the neat things about this particular annexation is that it predominantly takes in, it's on the south end where a lot of the numbers are going to change. And that's because that's where the student population is. And that's where, you know, we brought in a lot of Purdue University. So with that understanding, you know, Councilor Steve Dietrich, he's working with Councilor Ann Hunt, Councilor Peter Bunder, and our new counselor, Nick DeBoer, to make sure that that does not happen, that the numbers don't get skewed and that people don't get pushed out of their existing positions or districts. And with that understanding, with that spirit of cooperation, sure, is there going to be somebody that says, wait a second, I always like to vote for, you know, Ann Hunt, now I have to vote for Peter Bunder. I don't like that. That's possible, but anytime there's change, there's always going to be somebody that's unhappy. But the fact of the matter is that we've got about a month to do it. There's been some preliminary redistricting proposals submitted to the council. They're willing and ready to work on it. We're going to have a couple work sessions sometime yet this month to get this thing accomplished, and we should have a finished product ready by the next council meeting.
Is a month enough time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like I said, these guys have been through this exercise once before. And, you know, you look at the geographic footprint of West Lafayette, it's not that big. A lot of the districts are pretty much common sense just because of the neighborhoods that are there. There's some physical boundaries, whether they be roads or highways. So it's not going to be that difficult to draw them. And again, understand, we're not just going to take everything off the board and recreate a new West Lafayette. The Area Plan Commission is intimately involved in this. And so it would be sort of ludicrous to start from scratch. you know, just sort of if we were going a grid, you know, laterally to go vertically. That wouldn't make much sense.
As this redistricting happens, I wonder if you are thinking of or have any ability to think about an eye towards future expansion of the mm-hmm. city, because, of course, the most recent annexation did not include everybody that you initially mm-hmm. wanted to include. I'm assuming that there's still talk with those people to eventually become city residents proper. Can you think about the way the city might eventually expand as you redistrict here?
Absolutely. And that was a great example of democracy in progress. I mean, we went into those neighborhoods and we got chewed up and spit out. The folks that showed up at these public meetings did not have any interest in being annexed. And we listened to them. We said, okay, even somebody as limited as me, I get it. We won't bring you in. But the fact of the matter is that annexations are awesome for growth. They're awesome for, changing the makeup of your community, but they're also awesome in the responsibility of being able to provide services. And we're really focused on that. The state empowers you by statute to grow logically and practically. But sometimes if you're not careful, you can grow at a rate that causes gaps in service. When you bring in residential areas, just by virtue of the tax math, residential property doesn't pay very much with property tax caps and the things that have happened over the past few years. They don't pay very much when it comes to services. So if you're predominantly a residential community like West Lafayette and you bring in more residential area, you got to be real careful because you could get yourself in a situation where the cost of services doesn't equate to the revenue that you're bringing in. And also, I'm a firm believer in looking after what you have. We've got a lot of developable areas in the city of West Lafayette. We've got a pretty neat and tidy footprint right now. We're working cooperatively with Purdue University, and we can finally say with absolute 100% accuracy that West Lafayette is the home of Purdue University. And so we're pretty satisfied with what we have. There might be a few parcels that we'll bring in just because they're on our septic, and that will just sort of clean up some of that area. But right now, I'm pretty satisfied with what we have. It seems that the population is pretty content with what we have. We still have some folks that, are still, I don't know, I think they would have rather have stayed in the county, and they make that opinion known pretty often. But the fact of the matter is that we're one big community now, and we're just going to make sure that we're able to take care of ourselves.
I find that when having had conversations with quite a number of mayors, I find that when things like annexations happen or things like moving from a Class 3 to a Class 2 city happen, there's often some sort of financial or logistical motivation for making that happen. And I wondered about the Class 2 designation. Is there so much money to be made or such a logical change to be made that really helps the city function more efficiently that it makes sense to do it so quickly and have to redistrict so quickly rather than, say, waiting until the next municipal election cycle? I mean, what's the benefit, I guess, for doing it so immediately?
Well, the Class 2 designation, really, there's very little change that the average citizen would know. It's more administratively. There's some different dynamics that we will be doing with our internal mechanisms. For instance, for one, I will no longer be the president of the council, nor will I be the presiding officer of the council or the president of the Board of Works. That will go to people who are currently on the council, and I'm going to miss that. I have a lot of fun doing the council meetings and the Board of Works meetings. That's going to be something that's going to be difficult to let go of. And there's also going to be greater representation. We're going to be adding two councilors. So that's really the biggest change. Internally, we go from having a clerk treasurer to having a controller who is appointed by the mayor and then a clerk who is an elected official. It's an executive elected official. That'll be a little bit different. But other than that, there really won't be that much change. But when it comes to finances, it really is more of a situational thing than it is a statutory thing. And that is that, when there's money being distributed by the state, it goes down the logical line numerologically. The class one city, which there is one of, they get the first nod, the class twos do, and then the class threes. And we had a pretty good strong example. And I don't know that that's written down, so I'm just speaking from experience. But we had a strong example of that when it came through when we were doing the relinquishment of the state roads within our communities. Some of the class two cities got a really sweet deal. They were the first folks that were involved in the conversation about the relinquishment program. And by relinquishment, it's the state highways going back to the local governments. And then the class three cities sort of got what was left over. And that's why we're still in negotiation with some of the parts of 52. You know, we have a lot of stuff there that needs to be taken care of, and we want to make sure that we're in a position to not just take care of it now, but to maintain it for the future.
So you basically feel like you're moving up several rungs on the ladder here,
yeah,
where these sorts of conversations are happening.
Yeah.
And even if you're not making more money, it sounds like you have mm-hmm. access to higher level thinking, higher level decision making.
Correct. Correct. I mean, this community is marketed as a community. I think that, you know, when Howie, whatever the guy's name is, Brian Howie, I think, he wrote an article a couple of weeks ago about the state of Indiana and the future of Indiana. And they said that there will basically be 9 major metropolitan areas that are going to have significant influence over the direction of the state. And Lafayette and West Lafayette was included in that list of 9. And so people look at us as kind of a general communal area. But now that we're both Class 2 cities, I think that ups the ante. We'll even get more attention.
Did you feel that Lafayette was getting stuff West Lafayette was not?
You know, that's kind of tough because you can always look over your shoulder and say, hey, what about us? But the fact of the matter is that, you know, we have benefited significantly with a cooperative spirit with the state of Indiana. You know, we have had some great things happen with NDOT, and we've had some lousy things happen with NDOT. But that's just the nature of the game, you know. We were very fortunate in being able to kickstart 231 and get that done in a very short period of time. Then Governor Daniels, and again, it was one of those things that I was a brand new mayor and I didn't know anything. So I picked up the phone and called Governor Daniels and said, hey, we got a great spot to get this road finished. And voila, you know, 3 short years later, there it was. So we've had a lot of really great success stories working with the state in West Lafayette. And then there's other times when it's not been so great. You know, most recently it's been the stoplight at 231 in Cumberland. I really, really, really want a stoplight there. And I've made that clear to anybody that'll listen to me at the state level, whether it be our representatives or whether it be the governor's office or whether it be the chiefs of NDOT. And hopefully they will respond to that. You know, we've been having this debate prior to our first fatality out there, and I absolutely don't want to see another one.
Well, we have run out of time, but we look forward to doing this again next month, and enjoy the vacation that's allowing us to pre-tape with you today.
There you go. Thanks so much, Stan.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. A reminder, you can always find archived broadcasts of these shows at our website, WBAA.org. You can click on the Ask the Mayor link if you're so inclined. Always send questions to any of our mayors by emailing ask@WBAA.org. Or you can tweet your questions to @WBAA News on Twitter. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a nice afternoon.